At Lowe's, loyalty is royalty. With Christmas right around the corner, treat yourself for less during the holiday season. Rewards members get early online-only access to Black Friday doorbuster deals on Thanksgiving Day, like the Hisense side-by-side fridge, just $799. Not a member? Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid 11/27 only on Lowe's.com. Member only doorbusters and Midnight Eastern. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. See Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 17, The Defense. This week, we heard a breakdown of what the defense presented at the trial, as well as Graddick's closing argument. This episode has raised a lot of listener questions, and Bob, Janet, and I are here to dive into them. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
Just one thing for housekeeping, and I mentioned last week that there's going to be a Thanksgiving break. I think I've got that figured out, so... this is the plan. This coming Sunday, so 2 days from now, there's going to be an episode on next week. We haven't talked about what day, but next week we'll record the follow-up for that. Next Sunday, there will be an episode. That's the Sunday before Thanksgiving. After that episode, we won't be back until a week from that Friday. So we're going to take the Friday right after Thanksgiving off and that weekend off, and then we'll be back for the follow-up after that. So just so you guys know, you've got two more main episodes coming, and then we're taking a week off. So just want to, and we'll remind you guys about that last week. Just want to get everybody a heads up. So I think we didn't just bail out on you for that week. That's what's going on. Other than that, we can get right into this thing. I talked a little bit about during the Patreon pregame that I wanted you guys to kind of hear the defense closing, and I have a lot of thoughts on it. I didn't really want to get into it because I wanted to put it out there and I wanted you guys to kind of absorb it and kind of formulate your own opinions on it. From what I've seen on social media since then, most people have the same thoughts I had. So now we can talk about it a little bit. So before I even get into you guys, I'm curious what you think about it. I'll tell you my thoughts on it. Remember when Dr. Jackson was on and she said that there was some sort of like mental decline,
yes,
health issue, something going on, yeah, with Graddick?
Yeah.
As I was going through the trial, on its face, it seemed like, yeah, like he didn't hardly put up any defense, like he didn't know what to do. But then as we like talked through it through the last week, like how do you counter a false confession when there's no recording, there's no transcript, you can't really put a false confession expert on the stand because there's nothing for them to work with. You don't want to put other cops on the stand that if you're dealing with a corrupt police department, if you put more of them on, it could just make it even worse. You know, the cross-examining of Larry Brooks, that's tricky because, you know, if you push too hard against a 12-year-old kid, that stuff, plus he was handcuffed with Dame not being there, which I know we're going to talk about that. So I was really like, I mean, he missed the mark on some big things with cross-examination, but I don't think he did that bad. And then I got to his closing argument.
Yeah.
And to me, I mean, I read that thing 50 times. It was so much to, in my opinion, for lack of a better term, gobbledygook.
Yes.
That's the word I'm going with.
Yeah.
That I was afraid that you guys were going to think I didn't know how to speak. I literally did.
Yeah,
I was like, this makes no sense. I was worried when Erica edited it, like, oh, she's going to edit this stuff out because it sounds like I'm making mistakes in the script.
Right.
And I'm not. That's just what he said.
Oh, I had to rewind a couple times because I was like, I like couldn't process it. And I'm like, I'm clearly in the wrong here, right? Like, I can't. Let's listen to this again. It sounds like I'm not the one in the wrong here.
Yeah. So you had the same thought. Like it just didn't make any sense to you. What'd you think, Janet?
No, I mean, and I unfortunately, I wasn't that surprised. I thought you teed it up nicely. To me, I wasn't as worried about people not getting it because I do think that you set it up somewhere in the episode or maybe even just in the follow-up beforehand. I knew going in, and it was not like a private conversation you and I had. I feel there was at some point you communicated perhaps an episode that was like, so the best story wins. The like, this is what we deal with when we deal with closing arguments and how important they are. Wait until you hear his. And I certainly remembered that, the conversation with Dr. Jackson about some mental decline. And again, I feel like I bring this case up a lot, but it did remind me of Adnan's case. It reminded me of Hayes' murder. It reminded me of Christina Gutierrez's closing argument. And I think one other case's closing argument that we have examined or I've heard in something else where you hear the closing argument and you're like, oh no, they can't finish a thought. Like they can't finish a thought. And it's actually heartbreaking. And if it were just a person that you were talking to across the table at lunch, your heart would break for that person. But now your heart is breaking for the entire legal system and certainly the person on trial and certainly the victims, because you're just, it's like a car crash. It's like a slow motion car crash. You're like, oh God, maybe he'll make a point that no. Okay. This sentence is starting off to maybe mean no. Like, oh, it was a very hard listen.
It was hard to listen to. And also it was what became more frustrating to me is I like circled back and I said, even though the defense was only the two witnesses and they weren't super effective, but he did score a big blow, I thought, with Larry. You know, he got Larry to acknowledge that he never said that he recognized any voices, that he recognized anyone. Like that was huge. And it was like, okay, that's why we're not going any further. You set him up with that. He's going to knock him down with his closing argument and then just shit the bed on the closing argument and just like confused everyone. And on top of that, you had it wasn't Collins. It was Benjamin, the other prosecutor that did the closing. Like she nailed it.
Yeah.
Like she nailed hers. It was infuriating to listen to because of what she was saying. But I mean, she was very good at like, let me paint a picture for you that equals he's guilty.
Right.
And then Graddick came up with just a bunch of nonsense. And what I didn't get into, because the rebuttal, because, you know, the state gets the last word too. The rebuttal was pretty concise from the state. And essentially, so his kind of whole thing was, you can't just assume he's guilty. You can't just assume. It's like, no, it's like, tell him he's innocent. Tell him how you know.
He just stopped short every time.
Yeah. And then just real quick, just so you guys know, the prosecutor's rebuttal to that. I mean, they got up and said, you know what? He's right. But you know what you also can't do? You also can't just assume or imagine that he's innocent, that he's innocent. He confessed. He told you he did it.
Right.
And that is like, well, your 20 minutes of rambling just got undone in 10 seconds.
You know, you talked about how you felt like Graddick scored a lot of points or should have scored some points with what he got Larry to say. But I feel like for me, it didn't translate as well as it did for you.
I agree. I mean, I feel like you could easily say, like, we talk about it all the time. Like, yes, it's yes, a witness is supposed to be more reliable right away. But also there are other situations where someone's like, I was in shock. I wasn't processing correctly. And then later on, I realized, wait a minute, I do know that voice. Like you could argue your way through how he didn't. And did anyway. I think I interrupted you, Zach. I'm so sorry.
No, you're fine. I mean, that's where I was going that way too. But the whole idea of like, yes, he did get Larry to say, I never told anybody that I could identify anybody physically or by their voice. But that was the end.
Yeah.
Right. To me, as a layman, and I think I'm not the only one, I'm going to sound like an idiot right now, but it's fine. I'm not the only idiot in the world.
Certainly not.
You need to tell me why that matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I meant.
Right? So he scored the points by getting Larry to say that, but I don't know what that means per se.
Right. You're exactly right. And that's what I meant by, and kind of what I meant in the episode too was, I think I said, if the jury was paying attention, if they caught it. So like I don't think that like, he scored a blow there in the way that like the jury would have been shocked. Like they would have had to have really been paying attention to it. But then my thought was, okay, now you got him to say it. And you and you pulled your punches because you don't want to go attacking a 12-year-old on the stand.
Mm-hmm.
Now in the closing, you hammer on it. And you make very clear to the jury, if I was the defense attorney, you make very clear to the jury, look, there was manipulation going on by these officers. Larry Brooks just told you that when he was first interviewed, he didn't recognize a voice. He didn't see a person. He didn't have any idea who did this. But then after he spends time with these officers, then the story changed. Like I would have like really like made exactly what you're saying, Zach, like make the jury understand. And that's where it was like, so when I was reading the cross-examination or the direct examination of Larry, when he recalled him, I'm like, okay, careful. I literally, when I'm reading these, I try to like, I'm putting myself like in like that place. Right. And I'm reading it, you know, as it's going through and I'm just like, I'm literally thinking like, careful, careful. Careful. Okay, you got it. You got what you needed. And he did. I'm like, and he did it. He pulled out. Like he got what he needed. He didn't push. He pulled out. And my thought was, okay, now you have something that you can turn into a very clear narrative in your closing. And then he just didn't.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That's that was my thoughts on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's, I mean, that's what I felt. It's like I listening to you say it afterwards, I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But listening in real time to what he said, I'm like, okay. Yeah.
Right.
And?
Yeah. And even if you read the full testimony, it's like, it's not very long, but you definitely, when you're reading it, you're like, okay, what just happened? And that's what I, again, was saying, like the jury would have had to have been paying attention. But because it's like you said, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, okay, why does that matter?
I feel like, and I know that's not always plausible, but I feel like there's so much of that where something, it gets put out there and it's just like, this is this, and this means this. And yes, it absolutely does. But to a person that doesn't quite understand it, it means nothing.
Right. Or a person that's been listening to testimony all day and they're just like, what? That was one sentence that I maybe didn't quite grasp the meaning behind. You know? Yeah,
absolutely.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Yeah, I mean, not to draw a huge circle around it and we can move on into people's questions. But yeah, I really was left so uneasy after Graddix, after you read Graddix's clothing, which, by the way, you sold it. I mean, like, you definitely you did a good job. It's not like you were just reading coldly. You know what I'm saying? You weren't just reading like a robot. Yeah. Like you were trying to put some passion into it. And so that was part of the like, speaking of like the way you just described, like he's got it, you got it. Be careful is like doing one of those claw games where it's like, yeah. Oh, he's mm-hmm. almost got the toy. He's almost got, he's lifting. Oh, he dropped it. He dropped mm-hmm. it. Oh, he's going to go back in with something else. Oh, he's got, now he's got this. Oh, he dropped it. Like that's how it felt. And by the very end, and maybe I'm misremembering, but I just remember feeling like I almost felt like if you already had decided that you 100% thought that Chris must be guilty, I almost felt that you could interpret his closing as yes. permission. Like you could, like yep. it was like, I mean, if you've made up your mind, guys, I wouldn't feel great about it, but it is up to you to make up your minds. Like you're going to make the decision you're going to make. Just make sure it's a good one. Like, what are you? That's like the dad telling the teenager, like, make good choices. Go out and yeah. stay out as long as you want. It's
and
like,
they
well,
never
anything
make good
could
choices.
Happen. Yeah, anything could happen. Why yeah. are you? So, yeah, I just it was a huge letdown to feel like I think he just told them it's OK to find him guilty.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt the same way. I was so frustrated. Poor Erica, because, you know, it was so hard. It's very easy for me to write a script and read it because I'm writing my voice, right? It's always a little challenging. And you know this, Janet, from your work. Like, it's always a little challenging to read a script someone else wrote.
Yeah.
Especially when it's not intended to be a script. But this is, right? It's a closing mm-hmm. argument.
Right.
Like, this was a speech. And usually closing arguments for me are easy to read because they're written to be read.
Yes.
Right? This one was such a, like, the amount of swear, I swear through the whole thing, I'm like, and what is he saying? Like, what is he even trying to say? I'm like screaming into the, we use this little dog clicker thing
right.
to mark retakes.
Yeah.
And it's just like, click, click, click. I'm like, apologize. I'm like, Erica, I'm sorry. I don't know. I can't piece this sentence together because I don't know what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
Like, it was that bad for
yeah.
me.
I get it.
Yeah. And then the frustration as I'm like reading through it, because I try to put some inflection and stuff on it. I'm trying to like put myself in his position. I'm literally like, okay, I'm standing in front of the jury and I'm trying to, and I'm just like, this sucks. Like, this is not working. I wouldn't say this at all.
Right.
The whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For good reason. For good reason. You want to get into some of these questions and comments?
Yeah, let's do that.
So definitely multiple comments, very understandably, from people who are just kind of, again, baffled by Dame not being available, looking for follow-up on that. I'll just start with Sarah says, I'm surprised that the absence of a police person means that the statement they have taken isn't admissible. Surely any written statement could be read out somehow? There must be plenty of reasons why someone can't be in court. And if it was written down, is that not evidence enough?
So there's a whole lot there about Dame, and I'm probably answering if there's more questions about him. But first things first, the first thing I wanted to know, and many of you wanted to know, is Where was he?
Yeah, Sue answer, definitely was like, where was he?
Yeah, I don't know where he was, but so then I want to know, okay, was he still employed with the police department? And I haven't, and I've talked about, I need to file a FOIA request for like personnel records. I'm curious to know like a little more detail on it. But this is what I do know. He's deceased now. I don't know how he's deceased. I know that in 2004, he was actually charged with sexual assault. Okay. Charges were dropped. I want to be clear about that. The charges were eventually dropped. But I found some newspaper articles in 2004 that say Gary police officer charged with, the headline is charged with rape. So what we can deduce from that is in this trial is in 2001. In 2004, he's still a Gary police officer, which meant he was still with the force. So what I've been able to figure out up till now is he was still working for the police department at the time of trial. He continued to be working for them afterwards. He was charged with a serious criminal offense. That charge was dropped. I don't know what else happened beyond there. And then he's deceased now. So that's what I know about Dame. Another thing I've really been racking my brain and having some conversations with you know, people that work in the legal field about this, about what could Graddick have done?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there was a way to get Dame's statement in. And this is kind of what I came up with as a non-lawyer, but I did run it by, you know, an attorney who agreed that it would have worked is a little dangerous maybe or tricky with Larry on the stand. But one of the exceptions for hearsay is for purposes of impeachment. So what Graddick needed to do that he didn't do is he needed to, when he had Larry Brooks on the stand, say, did you ever tell an, now he asked it in a roundabout way, but very directly say, did you ever tell an officer, did you tell an officer on the scene that night that you did not recognize any voices, that you did not see any people, and that you have no idea who did this? And that's, if he'd been that direct with it, one of two things happened. Either Larry's honest and says, yeah, that's what I said. Okay, and you leave it alone, which again is kind of roundabout what he did. He did, but he didn't hit it on the head the way he needed to.
Mm-hmm.
Or if Larry were to say in that circumstance, no, I never said that. Because remember, he just testified, Christopher Bynum did it.
Right.
If he had said, if his response to that was, no, that's not what I said, then you can bring in Dame's report as impeachment evidence. So that would have been the way to get it in. So just kind of a Monday morning quarterbacking, looking back on it and trying to figure out a way, like, is there any way, did the state have him so handcuffed that he couldn't have got it in? That, I believe, and I know we have some attorneys that listen, or some of them are in the chat or that work in the legal field, but that was my understanding, is if you had asked the question that directly,
mm-hmm.
and if Larry denied it, then you could have brought it in as impeachment evidence. That's how he could have got Dame's report in. And I think he should have.
Mm-hmm.
I think he absolutely should have. Again, you are risking, you know, turning the jury off to you because you're pushing kind of hard against a 12-year-old like that. But at the same time, I mean, you've got, it's at some point, like, you have to show them. I mean, you got this kid that was there that night saying your client did it over and over and over again. You have to show them that was bullshit, that he doesn't know who did it. And that, to me, was the only way to do it. So just thought I'd share with that, because I thought it was an interesting thought exercise for me to figure out, like, how could it have gotten in?
Yeah, there's so much stuff about hearsay and that kind of thing that I guess I still don't understand, even though I've definitely listened to, like, multiple people explain through stuff. But I mean, you know, I feel like there's cases where the medical examiner has moved to Australia and a different medical examiner just goes up with that medical examiner's report and is like, they found this, 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 and this. Do you agree with them?
Right.
Yes, I do. Like, how is that not, you know what I'm saying? How could you not call someone else up to read the report and be like, the report says this. This is what this person said.
The problem is that their police reports are a weird thing.
Mm.
I don't pretend to understand the rules on it, but I know that, like, a narrative report is considered hearsay. It's considered, because it's not evidence. It's just something someone said, right? As compared to, like, medical findings, I think,
okay.
I think that's where the distinction comes in.
Yeah.
Also, in that case, there's probably nobody objecting to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So if it's like the medical evidence, unless there's something in the medical evidence that's super damning to your client.
Right.
Because generally it's going to be the state that's going to put that person on,
right.
and say, we're going to have this person read in the medical report, you know, even though they weren't the ones that performed the autopsy. There's usually some connection, right?
Yeah.
So, like, they were, you know, they work in that office. They weren't there when it happened, but, you know, they oversaw it. They signed off on the report. There's something there that connects them to it.
Yeah.
And then the defense is not, like, if there's no good reason for them to, like, really fight it, then it probably doesn't get fought as much. Whereas this, the state, as you heard if you read some of the trial transcript, was fighting tooth and nail
mm-hmm.
to keep anything about danger. When he was questioning Moxley, as soon as he started talking to him, it's like, object, bench conference. This is just another way he's trying to get Moxley's testimony
mm-hmm.
in. Or Dame's testimony
yeah.
in. Yeah.
Well, and Ashley had, you know, said, like, if somehow this led to a new trial, if they could find him, that would mean his report would be admissible now. And now you've let us know that he's deceased. So
correct.
That avenue yeah. is definitely closed to us.
Hey, everybody. Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
And then Kelly was also wondering, like, is there not, do you not get to say, I mean, I'm sure there's other reasons why you would want your trial to move forward or whatever, but that your attorney could say, like, this is a really important report. We want a continuance so that you can find this guy and I can put him on the stand. We'll wait.
Yeah, I think they should have. I don't know. I'm sure that would come up to the judge's discretion. So I don't know how effective it would have been. But I feel like I would, if I was the attorney, I would try it. I would put it on the record that, you know, we need this officer to testify. He's unavailable. We need a continuance until we can get him in here. They also probably should have made sure that he was available, like get a subpoena served to him or something beforehand.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I don't, maybe Gredig just didn't occur to him that the state would hide a police officer. Right. Which appears, I'm not saying that's what happened, but it sure seems like that's what happened.
It does feel that way.
Yeah. So maybe they didn't think, well, he's a cop. It'll be easy to get him in
that
here.
There's cases in Baltimore where we've heard about that for sure, mm-hmm. too, where they're like, I don't know. He's in the wind. We don't have him. We just don't have him.
After the trial, they show up for work.
Exactly. And Faith, you had asked about employment records. So hopefully that helped to hear a little bit more about his background and some of the stuff that came up during Bob's search. Going into Graddick, Kathy says it doesn't seem like Graddick had much to work with. He needed Dame's interview. He needed the phone number written on the paper at Michelle's, both of which conveniently disappeared. He certainly couldn't tear down a 12-year-old boy, as we've talked about, who had just lost so much and was likely traumatized. And then that's exact that Kathy, you nailed it. Could he have asked about Dame's report? That's you. That's it. Kathy's thinking just like Bob.
He couldn't come through and say, you know, why is this written in a report? But like I said, there was a roundabout way to get to it. You have to get him to lie on the stand so that you can impeach him with that evidence.
Yeah. Well, Chris S. had a question about, and I don't know if this is like something that you were going to talk about or if you know about this, but Chris had said that Graddick was found to be ineffective in some higher court, perhaps. Does that sound familiar?
I don't think so. I mean, it certainly wasn't ineffective to the level where the conviction was overturned, which is always possible too. So there, you'll see that sometimes with like a Brady violation where they'll say, okay, this was Brady material. It definitely was exculpatory and it wasn't turned over to the defense, but it's not material, meaning, but we don't think it would have changed the outcome of trial. So there could have been something like that where they're like, yes, Graddick was insufficient or ineffective in not cross-examining someone properly, something like that. But we don't think that it would have changed the outcome of the trial. And therefore, you know, so then it would be on record that he was ineffective, but still not overturned the conviction.
So that happened in 2009. That's almost exactly what happened.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah. A federal appeals court in Chicago ruled that Bynum's trial lawyer was ineffective assistance, but then it threw it out because it basically said that it wouldn't have changed the conviction.
Yeah.
Boy, so that's tough when one of the sort of benchmark things that you can claim that should protect your rights is ineffective assistance of counsel, and to then have those panels agree and still say, like, still though, too bad. And I'm sure the confession had everything to do with that. But
listen, hold on to your hat, because the next 3 weeks I'm covering things that came out during the post-conviction proceedings and the post-conviction investigation that will blow your mind that these did not result in the conviction being overturned.
Great.
It's nuts.
Ugh, great.
The things that, I mean, it's going to do wonders for us to better understand what happened, but the fact that none of it was successful in overturning the conviction is infuriating. Mm.
Just to stay on Graddick for a little bit longer, Sarah, I just want to call out your observation. Sarah says, I'm not sure it was a smart move for Graddick to remind the jury of all the potential witnesses who didn't testify, because while he tried to put it all in the prosecution, he didn't call them as witnesses either.
Yeah, I agree.
Very tough. Yeah, very tough to be like, where's so-and-so? And then the jury could be thinking, well, then why didn't you call so-and-so if it was so important that you hear from them?
Yeah, and especially like, because the jury doesn't know Dame was unavailable. Yeah, and they have to see, like, from a jury, like, yeah, you don't need to prove innocence. It's the state's burden. But really, you have to prove innocence. And when it gets to, first of all, you only have a day and a half of the state's case. Then you move on to the defense case in chief, and they're like, well, we've got two witnesses for 5 minutes each, and that's all we got. And then I'm going to give you this gobbledygook closing argument that just does nothing but confuse you. And basically, as Janet said, kind of gives you permission to say guilty.
Yeah. Camila had an interesting question that I think would be fun to kind of get into a little bit. Camila says, I'm probably focusing on the wrong thing here. No such thing. But how is a question like, have you ever known suspects to lie in order to minimize their involvement allowed? Is this something a defense lawyer can object to? That's like needing to know if it rained on the night of the murder. So you put a meteorologist on the stand and say, hey, has it ever rained in this city?
No. Well, the thing with situations like that, they always drive me crazy, too. But like, what the judge will say if you object is the jury is the finder of fact. And if someone, you are allowed to have someone speak to their expertise. So what wouldn't, and that question is very deliberate. So the question you want to ask, the question the prosecutor wanted to ask is, did Chris Bynum lie in order to minimize his role? That is not allowed because you can't make that kind of inference. He's not a psychological expert that can answer that question. You can't know what someone else is thinking. So what is allowed is to say, in your 25 years of experience, have you ever known a suspect to change their story or to lie in order to minimize their involvement? And then they just leave that out there for the jury to infer whatever they want to infer because they're the finder of fact. So you could object, but it would be unsuccessful.
I mean, that's kind of a cinematic. That I feel like we see that trope play out even in like the cinematic version of of courts, that it's just like, and is it possible that a child could get lost? No more questions, Your Honor. Like, it's very smug. Yeah.
It's actually a real thing.
Yeah.
As somebody, remember in my previous life, I served as an expert witness on multiple occasions as a training officer in the fire department and as an arson investigator. And you get those kinds of questions where it's like, we can't ask you about a certain thing, but we say, sometimes, have you ever known in your 10 years of experience where someone will start a fire by putting a candle under a paper towel roll?
Yeah.
Is that something you've ever experienced before?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Now, I can't say, and usually like that, that's actually pretty close to a real example. In that case, like in my pretrial prep, we were talking about this in the pregame, how arson investigators and behavioral analysis at the same time, like, it's not junk science until you make it junk science by trying to claim you can prove something you can't prove.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they would ask me in pretrial prep. So if we ask you like how you think the fire started, I would say that I can't tell you how the fire started. I can tell you where the fire started.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how the fire started. Well, what do you think happened? I think they probably had a candle underneath the paper towel roll and it got it going. Okay, so if we ask you that, I'm like, I can't testify to that. I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hypothesis. That's all that is. So then they figure, okay, so how can we, because they could have, a different arson investigator, they might have said, well, I can tell by this pattern and this, that, and this, and the other, that that's what happened, but they would have been full of shit. You couldn't prove it.
Right.
Like, I can tell you where the point of origin was, and I can tell you there's no natural heat source there. So there had to have been some sort of heat source at that point of origin. I can't identify what that heat source was.
So in a situation like that, now we're really getting in the weeds, but we're almost done with the question, so don't worry. But is that a situation where, like, you can just, I guess I don't know how much you can bandy that back and forth, but couldn't someone, like, recross and get up and say, is that what you think happened in this situation? Or, like, you know what I'm saying? I guess you wouldn't ask that question because you don't know that's, or could you, and can you prove that that's what happened here? And then you're hoping that the expert will say, no, I cannot.
Yeah, and that's exactly
whatever,
what happened.
Yeah.
So where was the point of origin? I believe the point of origin, the evidence indicates the point of origin was here on the kitchen counter. Okay. And were you able to identify a heat source? And I was not able to identify a natural heat source. There's no electrical outlet there. There was no stove there. There was nothing in that point of origin that I was able to locate that could cause that kind of fire. And then the next question is, well, in your years of experience investigating fires, have you ever seen a situation where someone might put a candle under something flammable and get it going? And yes, I have seen that. No further questions. And then the defense comes up and says, can you prove that that's what happened here? Did someone put a candle underneath that? And I just answered honestly. I'm like, I can't prove that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And that's one of those no further questions.
Right. Right.
That's how the defense.
Everybody's trying to button
it up. And that's how
a
lot of. Yeah, if you read a lot of trial transcripts, you'll see like that's how they play out a lot.
Yeah.
So like that piece that she's talking about here in her question like didn't surprise me at all. It's very common for things to play out that way. It's just a way, essentially what you're trying to do is to plant a seed in the jury's mind and hope they run in your direction with it.
Yeah. The last question I have is from Jessica, who's going out a little more, who's going a little bigger in the big picture of all of this and is just still struggling with why the DA even took this to trial. She says it seemed like the detectives didn't want to put in any work to solve the case, or maybe didn't care about the victims. But why didn't the DA demand more evidence to back up the confession? Is there a history of corruption or incompetence in the DA's office?
I don't know about in the office. I've started to do some work. We're going to get into that. Like, I've started to do some work on these officers, Detective Donald in particular. There certainly was, and we'll get into those details later, but some accusations of corruption regarding him. I don't know. I think that it's, you know, I this is just an assumption, though. It seems to me that there was just a culture there. Remember, they were like the murder capital. Gary, Indiana was one of the murder capital of the United States at the time. Their murders per capita were huge. And I think they probably had a culture where it's just like, we're just closing cases.
Yeah.
We're closing cases. And that's the problem with most prosecutors' offices is the fact that they are incentivized to get convictions, right? That's what gets them reelected. That's what keeps their job is we take murderers to trial, especially in an area that has a high, you know, a lot of violence.
Sure.
You know, if you live in a city where you don't feel safe because there's a lot of violence, what are you looking for in a prosecutor? You're looking for the person that is putting people away that are committing acts of violence, right? Getting them off the streets. So, you know, I think there becomes a time in a lot of prosecutors' careers where they stop really even looking at these cases as like real people. And they're just looking at them as this is just another case I need to win.
And what a gift. Something what a gift to just be have to have a confession handed to you.
Yeah, that was something that was disgusting to me, but at least he was honest with me. And did David Dobbs and Ed Ade's case when I met with him. He was like, look, if we got the wrong guy, fine. You know, once I finally, after all the a year of battling with him, he's like, if we got the wrong guy, fine. I mean, I have no problem, you know, helping you find what you need to find to overturn the conviction. I think his exact words to me were like, look, once I go to trial, I don't give a shit. Like, my job is to win. So I'm finding whatever angle I can do to win. And it was like that was so honest and so disgusting to me. Yeah. And it's not just him.
No.
You know, I think there's a culture in prosecutors' offices in general, again, particularly when you're in a place that has a high rate of violence, because that's how you are successful. That's how you are judged by how many of those violent people are taken off the streets. And especially back in the year 2000, no one was looking to see, did you get the right guy? Oh, you arrested another black guy from that neighborhood for committing murders? Good job. Like, nobody's looking any further than that.
Right. Well, that's all we have. I look forward to being flabbergasted once again next week and the following weeks.
Yeah. So I'm excited about this. Make sure you tune in on Sunday. So we've kind of closed out the first phase of our work the way we normally do it here, which is to examine the initial investigation and to examine the trial to determine if the person that we're working with was wrongfully convicted. In my opinion, it has been conclusively shown there's no evidence whatsoever that Chris Bynum had anything to do with this. I think there's plenty of counter evidence to indicate that he didn't. In my mind, he is certainly an innocent man that was convicted. So now our job shifts. Now our job is to try to find out, well, if not him, then who? And see if we can finally get justice for these victims and hopefully something that will result in Chris Bynum getting out of prison and going home before it's too late. And so in that regard, the first step in that is there have been some amazing investigators and attorneys that have worked on this case over the years. You know, Chris was convicted 24 years ago, almost 25 years ago. And they uncovered a lot, as I mentioned a little bit ago. They uncovered a lot that has not, unfortunately, resulted in the conviction being overturned. But it is very, very relevant to us. This is actual, real evidence that indicates gives us leads and indicates who might have actually committed this. And that's a jumping off point for us where we can say, okay, that if we can pick up the ball where they put it down and see if we can carry it a little further and hopefully do some real work with this. So in that regard, this on Sunday's episode, we're going to be covering the forensic evidence, the evidence that came up and was discovered, was available, but wasn't put in front of the jury and wasn't discovered prior to the trial. And it's produced some really solid leads. And then next week is going to be, you know, more of the investigation that came afterwards. And then after Thanksgiving, an even more shocking one after that. So the next three episodes are going to be, I think, probably the most informative that we've had as far as trying to get a good idea of what actually happened here.
Great.
So make sure you tune in on Sunday, and then we'll talk to you guys all about it in next week's follow-up.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.